Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Big news this morning. Government of Canada announcing millions of dollars in new funding, four different research projects trying to figure out how to save the southern resident killer whale. 76 of these animals remain. They are similar to other killer whales, other orcas on this planet of ours. They are distinct and unique to our area, though. The southern resident killer whale, 76 of them remain. The last baby whale in this subspecies was born in November of the year 2015. It's been more than 2 years now since the last one was born. You don't have to be a genius to know that once a population of animals stops producing young, it's only a matter of time until it dies out. What is causing the lack of births? What is causing the little whales to wash up dead in places like Tofino? Starvation, one of the key factors suspected at this point, due to dwindling fish stocks, due to fish noise, due to any number of other factors. Can these animals be saved? Well, an individual who spends much of her professional time pondering this question is Misty McDuffie. She's a biologist with Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Welcome to the program once again. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you, Adam.
Give us your thoughts on the announcement that we saw today from the federal government.
Yeah, and it's more research to understand the problems facing these whales. But there's no action to actually reduce the threats that we know are threatening these whales. So they're good questions. It would be good to have a better understanding of some of these food web issues and the way noise affects these whales. But the bottom line is that we know that lack of prey is the biggest threat. And the way it's a threat is the abundance of that prey and the fact that vessel noise and disturbance interferes with their ability to catch that prey. So the biggest threat isn't the biology, it's the politics. And this, once again, has no actual measures to reduce the threats that the whales are facing.
In terms of actual policy changes, one of the recent ones that I can recall was the expanding of the exclusion zone around the whales. You couldn't go closer to them. We were mirroring the United States. I know there's also a proposed fisheries ban on the Chinook fishery off southern Vancouver Island, but I can't remember what the status for that one is. Do you know?
Yeah, I can speak to both of those.
Okay.
So yes, the government did say that they were proposing to harmonize the no-go distance from 100 meters to 200 meters. So they would harmonize that with the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And the great thing is the whale watching community took that on right away, and they said, you know what, we're implementing that for the beginning of this whale watching season, which it's really great to see from them. But the federal government hasn't actually implemented that. So.
Okay.
They've identified it as a proposal. But what they have done, and well, I will give them credit, is that they have recognized where the priority feeding areas are for these whales. And really, because the whales use the shorelines to successfully hunt, it's really a strip of shoreline that starts up near Nitnat, Pachina Bay on the west coast of Vancouver Island and comes all the way down almost to Souk.
Hmm.
And then starts again through Harrow Strait on the west side of San Juan, up the west side of Pender Island, again along the shorelines around Saturna, and then the approaches to the Fraser River, because these whales are following salmon that are migrating back to the Fraser. So the same place that fishermen are targeting those fish is the same place the whales will be targeting those fish. So what DFO has proposed is to recognize those feeding areas, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But they aren't proposing to close them all. In fact, the areas that they're proposing to keep open are the areas that receive some of the highest effort and the highest catches throughout that entire zone that I just described. So they've recognized that these areas are important, and they are said they're willing to close some that aren't as heavily fished as others. But what we really need to be doing at this point is closing those access areas to recreational fishing and also to whale watching.
How do the orcas actually hunt the salmon? You mentioned they use the shoreline. What happens?
So what they're doing is, these are toothed whales, and they're echolocating on the swim bladder of the fish. And they can use that echolocation to assess the size of the fish and where the position of that fish is in the water column. And we know that these whales want the biggest fish, the biggest Chinook. When I say fish, I'm really specifically talking about Chinook salmon. The biggest Chinook that they can catch. And one of the reasons is because of the high nutrient value and high fat value that those Chinook carry, but also the other reason is because they share their prey. So if one whale catches a fish, a salmon, then it's about 75% of the time that they will share that catch with other members of their pod or their family.
I can't imagine two giant whales sharing a tiny fish. Like, I can't even visualize that.
Sometimes it's a mother and calf, sometimes it's siblings, but one fish will hold. There's some incredible footage that Dr. John Ford at the Pacific Biological Center here in Nanaimo has. It's an underwater shot of one fish. It's a bit blurry, but you can see one whale is catching the salmon and the calf comes in and takes a bite out of it while the mother is holding the fish. It's really cool.
We can intuitively see the problem here, though, because as you've told us in the past, Chinook salmon now are much smaller than they used to be.
They are. And in fact, a paper has just come out recently documenting this decline in the size of these fish. And it's really an artifact. Like, there may be other things going on as well, but definitely it's an artifact of the way we fish. And because we're after the largest fish, the trophy fish.
Yeah.
So, and that's changed the age and the size structure of the population.
Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Missy McDuffie. She is an expert on the life cycles of the southern resident killer whales. She's a biologist with the Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Government of Canada announcing $3.1 million this morning for research projects. Government says that it's undertaking new initiatives aimed at protecting the whales. Our guest says we already know what's wrong. There's nothing in here that will actually change policy. A study, sure, it's great. Knowledge is great. Is what we need now action? And is that action something we can actually undertake? That question and more after the break. Stay with us.
Ship to shore, do you read me anymore? This line is bad and fading.
It's Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
The whales are in trouble. They are in serious trouble. We don't even know if they can be saved at this point. We know it's not the end of the world right now, but you can see it from here. 76 of them are left. There have been no successful births since November of 2015. There are 76 southern resident killer whales still in existence on this planet. They're all around Vancouver Island. Government of Canada announcing $3.1 million for four research projects today to study the issue. Our guest says the time for studies has come and gone. We need action now. Misty McDuffie is a biologist with Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Misty McDuffie, what are some of the policy changes the government could undertake now that you feel are necessary?
Well, I think they've made a good start with recognizing the priority feeding areas, and now they do need to close those areas to the disturbance from recreational fishing vessels and whale watching boats. And we sort of started on that line of how those boats interfere with their ability to catch food, but the sound of the engines can mask that echolocation that they're using to find the salmon.
Yeah.
And the physical presence of the boats can also act, and the lines in the water can act as barriers that will discourage whales from pursuing salmon that are going past the boats.
Yeah, and that makes intuitive sense to our audience, I think. You need a very precise resolution to be able to use echolocation to see a tiny fish in the water column far away from you, and with all the boat noise, it basically blinds the whales. It brings their vision way back.
Yeah. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, 250-386-1161. Let's go to Bev. Bev, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I've got a new slogan for your guest.
What's that?
Save the orcas, kill a seal.
Why is that?
A recent study out of Washington State, I'm not sure whether it was the University of Washington, indicated that 40% or more of Chinook salmon are eaten by the exploding populations of seals and sea lions.
Hmm.
So there was a discussion about years ago, the population of seals was 10,000. Now they're well over 300,000.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Masses of these salmon are consumed by other predators, and consequently are diminishing the supply to the orcas. Now, recreational fishers, relative to the commercial fishers, don't really take that many salmon. Mm. However, they do put millions and millions of dollars back into the economy. And I can tell you that the recreational fishers are very interested in biology, the saving of the whales, and have supported this stuff for years and years with massive amounts of economic contributions. The Save the Salmon Foundation and all of those folks are generally populated by recreational fishers who are as concerned about the stock of salmon as we are for the orcas. So,
it's a good point, Bev. Let's give our guest a chance to respond. I got lots of calls here. Mr. McDuffie, two issues there. One, seal population, are they to blame? Two, recreational anglers and fishers, do they really take that many salmon?
Okay, so on the first point, I think we have to look at the context, the history of what's happened to pinnipeds, the seals and the sea lions on this coast.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to 1970, when the Marine Mammal Protection Act came in,
yes,
we had killed 500,000 seals from this coast and about 50,000 sea lions. And so the increase that people talk about over the last several decades is the recovery of seals and sea lions since they've been protected in the 1970s.
Okay.
And so it's true that in Georgia Strait, the seal population has gone from about 10,000 in 1970 to about 40 to maybe 50,000 today for the Salish Sea. So 50,000, 300,000 would be talking the entire west coast of, you know, far more than the Salish Sea.
Okay.
And so then we got to look at where those seals are predating. And some of them are taking advantage of human structures like log booms, like lights, like a lot of infrastructure created by humans that increase their ability to predate. And it with seals, their heaviest predation is probably more on the juveniles than the actual adults. And when they're eating adults, it's primarily in the estuaries where they're returning, when adults are returning to spawn. So if we wanted to tackle if we accept that there is some places where seals may have an advantage more so than they did historically, then we should be addressing the structures that give them that advantage.
And in terms of the interference from anglers and recreational fishers, my understanding is that it's not the number of fish that they take, it's just their presence makes it harder for the whales to hunt in the first place, yes?
That's true through the Wand of Fuca, but
okay,
but we still have fairly strong numbers being caught in recreational fisheries, especially through northern British Columbia, Langara, and Haida Gwaii. And so they are also targeting the stocks that are migrating back to the Fraser River. So when you look at the total exploitation, the recreation is maybe not quite half, but getting up there.
250-386-1161, star 1070. Bev, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Don. Don, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, good morning. I was just going to comment on a few things.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the sports fishermen, they do target the Chinooks. They actually take the most Chinooks. They do, from time to time, take sockeye, a few pinks, and a few chums. But their focus is on Chinook salmon. And the idea that they pour millions of dollars into the economy, that probably is true. But the other thing that we have to consider, Adam, is that if they weren't fishing, they'd still be spending money on other things, and the economy wouldn't suffer. You wouldn't even notice the difference. Now, as far as your southern, your pod in the south there, they do eat all species. The reason why they focus on the Puget Sound Chinook or the Salish Sea Chinook and so on and so forth is because they really don't migrate. They tend, I think it's about two-thirds of them, stay in local waters. Hence, as long as the southern pod can feed off those fish, they tend to hang around. Mm-hmm. All nature follows their tummy, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
The real concern, and your guest hasn't brought this up, is the PCB levels in the southern waters. And what we're noticing now is that the salmon that tend to stay in Puget Sound and Salish Sea have high concentrations of PSBs, which is human, pollution. Mm-hmm. Now, having said that, when the killer whales eat those fish, they in turn absorb those contaminants, and hence that'll affect your birth rate and births in general. So really, I think it's a moot point. The DFO does have a record of destroying fisheries. They destroyed the East Coast fishery. They've done a pretty good job at destroying the West Coast salmon fishery, and I think they do favor the aquaculture industry because it's kind of like a man-made. It's kind of like a feeding lot, and there isn't the, the mandate to manage those because DFO is pathetic at managing anything. And we all know the term study things to death, and that's DFO. They will continue to roll out taxpayers' money, millions of dollars to study. But the idea of actually doing things, creating a symbiotic relationship with nature, it's not on. They just do not have that in their blood. And that's how I see it. So, I mean, it's kind of like watching or being forced to watch a car accident. You know what's going to happen, and you have to sit there and watch it. So until we change the approach, you can expect the killer whales to either die from poisons or die from starvation. Simply put, until you get DFO on side and really, you know, get the smart people. I was just going to say to your guests, I know John Ford personally, I remember when, back when he was, I guess, in his mid-20s, so to speak. That's when I met him. And he's kind of followed all along. And unfortunately, it's all political. And I agree 100% with your guess. This is so political, it's pathetic. Anyway, Adam, that's how I see it.
Dom, thank you for the call. Your thoughts, Mr. McDuffie.
Well, he raises a good point about the POP contamination. And what happens is that if these whales were healthy and were taking in the load of contaminants that they are consuming, they could care. One of the things that's happening is females are transferring that body burden that's stored in fats down to the calves. But when whales are older and they're suffering from food stress or malnutrition, they mobilize their fats, they burn their fats, and they mobilize those contaminants. And so that's how the contaminants really come into play, is because they're food stressed, they're not being stored in the fat because the fat is being utilized. So it's an important piece of why the failure of 70% of pregnancies over the last decade it's likely a factor in that.
We're still at zero new baby whales born since November 2015, right?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
It's happened very recently.
Okay. I think we have time for one more call before we wrap this up. Greg, it's you. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good.
One thing I wanted to bring up is I wrote a thing for one of the online papers about the water temperatures out there last year. Mm-hmm. We monitor the water temperatures right from the beginning of fishing time right up until the end. And we didn't see the whales around much because the temperatures had varied anywhere from about 47 degrees mm-hmm. up to a high of 55.8.
Hmm.
Now,
wow.
When the fish are, they're not going to come into waters that are that warm. So we didn't see as many Chinook. We didn't see a Pink's Run last year, which was split at the top of the island. I followed these waters for 30, 35 years, and I see what's going on. So we decided to keep track of what the water temperatures were out there.
Yeah.
Now, would you go to a grocery store where there's no food?
No.
No. Well, then, you know, like, there's a lot more variables than going on here than just one or two or, you know, Misty or whatever, picking one or two groups to go after. You know, there's a lot of things happening out there, and nobody has mentioned water temperature at all.
Well, let's get her to respond.
Water temperature has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I've got 2 minutes, so I'd love for her to respond to that. Greg, thank you. Mr. McDuffie, water temperature, how does that play into this?
Yeah, so what we're sort of seeing is that there was a term called the warm blob that was in the North Pacific a few years ago, and that warm blob has moved into the coast. And so we are seeing warmer water temperatures coastwide. It has a huge effect on salmon productivity, on their distribution, their numbers. So absolutely, all of these things are part of this food web dynamic and influence the presence and the amount of salmon, and then therefore where whales are going to look for that salmon.
Yeah, I recall a few months ago we had a DFO researcher on talking about the blob and how it disrupted the production of, I think they were called copepods, little tiny creatures at the base of the food chain that then rippled back up and were believed to be responsible for many of the salmon failing to come back on the runs a few years back.
Yeah, and those copepods have, they're slightly different in nutritional value between the north and the south. And what we're seeing in the south is more of those copepods with the lower nutritional value. So all of these things become really complicated in the food web dynamics, as your caller described, and play into how many salmon are there and where they are.
Mr. McDuffie, we appreciate your insight and your opinions as always. Any final thoughts for now?
Well, just that we were hoping for more from the federal government in terms of actual reduction to the threats that we're seeing to these whales.
We will watch the file closely. Misty, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Adam.
Take care. Misty McDuffie, biologist, Raincoast Conservation Foundation, 76 southern resident killer whales remain in existence. There has not been a new one born since November of the year 2015. In fact, the population has gone down since then. Most recent known death involved one of the younger whales, only a couple of years old, washed up dead with symptoms consistent with starvation. All right, we'll take a quick break at the latest from the newsroom. Afterward, it is Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan from Mulligan, Tam & Pearson. Stay with us.